I just wished he'd say, I'm going to dedicate, you know, $1 zillion to saving the Amazon. He would be the hero of the planet. He named his company after this river, and yet he ignores it as far as I can tell. I would like to meet him. If he's out there, please connect me.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Continuing our series on climate change, I have the pleasure of sharing with you a conversation I had with Meg Lohman, the pioneer of canopy ecology, studying trees in the treetops. In the past, scientists who study trees focused on tree trunks at about eye level, a practice that Lohman equates to a doctor who only examines your toes. For more than 30 years, Lohman has worked across 46 countries and 7 continents, designing hot air balloons, walkways, and other ways to explore and study the diverse biosphere up in the trees. Her recent book, The Arbonaut, A Life of Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees Above Us, is not only an introduction to the life of an arbonaut, the name she coined for canopy ecologists, but also a memoir. It starts with her childhood in Elmira, New York, and it moves on to her struggles as a smart young woman often battling sexism in male-dominated fields. In Australia, where she goes for her graduate work, Lohman decides on a thesis project that involves cataloging leaves, not realizing at first that this will require her to go up 100 feet and more into the canopy of the Australian rainforest. Undaunted, she fashions together some equipment, borrowing a sewing machine and making a harness out of seatbelt webbing and improvising a slingshot to get herself up into the treetops. And thus, the life of the Arbonaut is born. We also learn about her marriage to an Australian sheep rancher and the challenges of raising a family in the outback. Really, you're going to have to read the book. Incidentally, it would make a great present this holiday season. Also on your holiday list, you'll want to put a donation to the Tree Foundation. You'll find out more about that shortly. So I enjoyed your book very much. It's a riveting story. What a life.
Oh, gosh. Probably more like fiction, isn't it?
I think I knew you were a superhero when you started a bed and breakfast at the sheep ranch in Australia. I was like, what?
I'll tell you, you do have to innovate when you're in crazy places.
Yeah, that was one of the great things about the story. So I was wondering if you could just start by telling us a bit the story of how you became, as you call it, an arbonaut.
Sure. I guess I would admit that I was a very geeky kid. I don't think that word existed in the 1960s when I was a kid, but I certainly would have qualified for that word geek. I didn't do any of the normal things that all my little friends did in rural upstate New York where I grew up. And I wanted to go bird watching. I wanted to press wildflowers and collect snake skins. And of course, I was the laughingstock in that sense. So it probably made me a little shyer and more reclusive than most other kids. I did seek nature as an elixir to all that, which was great. And of course, I had a couple loyal friends that were willing to accompany me to make my little tree houses and do some other fun things along the way. But in growing up, I think without TV, without internet, in a very small rural town where there was no Smithsonian or any kind of scientist for role models, I did take to nature. And so I'm very grateful to have that outdoor play as my inspiration. And I kept playing outdoors, and I still play outdoors. In a sense, I'm a grown-up tree climber. I'm probably one of the few people in the world that gets paid to climb trees, whereas most of us outgrew that in our childhood.
That sounds lovely. And so specifically, the technique that you developed for climbing trees came out of your research in Australia. So can you talk about that a little bit and how that motivated you to come up with this new technique?
Sure. Of course, I'd never really been anywhere in the world to speak of. And I did not have a childhood of going to Paris and London and all these wonderful places. When I got a full scholarship to the University of Sydney, I really did think I would flunk out, but I thought maybe I could see a koala bear along the way. And I picked leaves for research because I loved the fall foliage of my childhood, and I was mystified why tropical trees were green all year round. I thought that was an amazing thing. There are zillions of tropical trees, and yet nobody seems to ever talk about them in the same context as they do these beautiful temperate trees that change color. So I picked leaves for my subject, not really thinking about how in the tropics they were hundreds of feet overhead. So when I first started working, my advisor said, "You will have to climb the trees." And holy cow, I was pretty nervous about that. But I did weld a slingshot in the school shop at the University of Sydney, and I borrowed a sewing machine and made a harness out of seatbelt webbing, and basically invented some gadgets that were based on the caving club, which went down. I wanted to go up, so I just needed a few things to help me overcome gravity. But I did use pretty similar kinds of mechanics to them. This was before the days of REI or all of these recreational outfitters where you can order ropes and you could order harnesses and do this and that. So it really was very homemade and very humble and probably very scary when I think about it. But that was the beginning of the toolkit. So ropes and harnesses were the beginning of the world of arbor nuts.
That must have been quite an experience the first time you went up in a tree. How high did you go?
I went 80 to 100 feet. Of course, the tropical trees in Australia were about 150, sometimes 200 feet, not as tall as redwoods or some of the trees in Malaysia and other parts of the world, but tall enough to get out of sight from the forest floor. And so I was pretty amazed to get up there. I was scared out of my wits. My muscles were sore for days because I kept trying to use my knees to grab the tree trunk, which of course would never have worked in a million years, but it's just that sixth sense that you try to employ at the time. And when I got through that very dark and quiet forest floor area where there's sometimes only 1% of light, and into that riotous canopy, everything was happening. Pollinators and things eating leaves and things, you know, flitting between fruits and flowers and things eating each other. So it was in a fabulous world of biodiversity that really isn't visible from the ground level.
One of the things you described that I found really striking is that it seems like animals don't react quite the same way when you're in the canopy as they might on the ground.
Absolutely true. And it's kind of wonderful that the birds were all stuffing their faces with insects right in front of my very eyes, and iguanas were eating bugs and things I think don't have the same sense of fear as they might on the forest floor from experience. And let's face it, I was one of the first arbor nuts in the world, so they didn't have any experience with humans coming into the treetops, much less assassinating them or something terrible. So it was a wonderful exchange of knowledge and a face-to-face communication.
That's incredible. You write at one point, well, actually in the beginning of the book, you write that the way that ecologists used to study trees primarily, which was roughly at chest height, on the trunk, that's the equivalent of a doctor only examining the big toe of a human.
Right. I am not an Einstein. I call this hit you over the head science. It's sort of amazing to me now to think about forest research, because 100 years ago, foresters thought walking through the woods and gazing at the tree trunks was all it took to understand the health of the forest. And having now climbed hundreds, if not thousands, of trees around the world, I realized that, holy cow, they were totally missing the forest for the trees, so to speak. There was just, 95% of all the action out of sight and out of reach. And it's quite surprising. Nobody really thought of that. But I'm sure when they cut the tree down and saw the canopy, it was devoid of life. The birds had flown away. The insects were all squished. There wasn't any reason for them to realize they needed to expend all this perspiration to get into the tree while it was alive. And nor did we understand all the values of trees that we do now, thanks to arbornauts, things like carbon storage and the amount of energy production and the amount of biodiversity homes that are up there. So, exploring the top of the tree really did lead us to redefine and really totally transform our understanding of trees.
Yeah, I like this term that you use at one point in the book of natural capital. Am I getting that right?
Correct.
And, you know, increasingly we're understanding more about trees, but one of the things we're understanding is just how many things they do for us as well, you know, including obviously give us oxygen, but mitigate weather changes, purify the water, and then, of course, convert sunlight into food, which then contributes to the whole food web. I wanted to ask you also about your passion for leaves, because the feeling I get reading your book is that this is something that started very early on for you. I've always loved trees. I feel like I've come to appreciate leaves specifically a little bit later in life because of, you know, increasingly understanding how incredible they are. I mean, photosynthesis alone continues to baffle us, it seems like. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, if you remember as a child what it was that compelled you about leaves, because I feel like that's something we could all benefit from appreciating more.
Right. Yeah, leaves are so cool. And when you think about it, they're this extraordinary machine that's really fueling the planet. So I've come to appreciate them more and more and more. And as I might have mentioned earlier, I guess I got my start thinking about those leaves that change color up in New England where I grew up, and then going to the tropics, which is a much bigger forest type globally. The tropical forests are perhaps, you know, more important in the sense of being bigger and having more trees, and yet they're green all year round, and nobody ever talked about that. Nobody ever even knew how long the leaves lived or what lived in them or what ate them. And so I just kind of gravitated to leaves. And another thing in science is, as you unfold your research career, you have to pick something to study that you can actually measure. It's really hard to measure 1,000 trees, but it's really easy to measure 1,000 leaves. So in a sense, it's a lot about statistics and asking questions in science that you can answer. So as a young student, I had to say to myself, what can I count? What can I measure? What's part of a tree that I can really get my hands around? And even though they were out of sight and pretty high up, I could manage to figure out how to get there and count them and measure them and compare them between trees and between heights and between forest types. And so those are the kind of questions that allow us to understand forests better. We can't just walk in and say, oh, wow, the forest is very cool, let's save it. But you've got to prove that there's this much foliage and there's this much photosynthesis and there are this many insects living on every leaf. So, you know, as a scientist, you have to really think about how it is you can present those results to make a difference for conservation and for policy.
Right. Yeah, so I was interested in the fact that, so you study the life cycle of leaves or how long leaves survived on a tree, and a lot of that is a function of the insects that eat them. One might sort of naively think that that's kind of a limited amount of information, but in fact, learning about that taught you all kinds of things about what was going on with the tree. So can you talk about that a little bit? What sort of broader lessons you can take from learning, for instance, how many of the leaves on a tree get eaten by insects?
Right. And, you know, at first, I just wanted to know how long the leaves lived. So I marked all these leaves, 1 to 1,000 or whatever. And then when I went back the next month to see if they were still up there, I'm like, oh my gosh, some insects have eaten right through my ink. Some insects have eaten the leaf. I was like so angry at these insects. And so that immediately taught me something. Holy cow, leaves face this amazing challenge because they can't run away from their enemy, and their enemy are insects. And so I had to say, I better look at what the enemy is doing and how come the enemy isn't totally winning. I started thinking, why didn't insects just eat 100% of the tree? Because it's stationary and it's stuck there. And that led me to look at chemicals and seasonality and how many insects there were at one point in time, and, you know, different kinds of fates of ages of leaves and toughness of leaves and all kinds of zillions of questions. So it was pretty amazing. But that whole interactive exchange between insects and leaves really does drive the planet in so many ways. And it opened the door for me to study both, you know, the zoology part of the canopy as well as the botany part of the canopy. And I wasn't an entomologist. I was a very quick learner to become an amateur entomologist. But fortunately, because I was exploring this whole new world, all the entomologists in Australia were so happy to receive my collections or look at my pictures and help me identify things and help me direct my questions about the insect side of my research. But it is pretty amazing. Every gardener knows insects are everywhere and they eat almost every leaf. And to answer your question, probably 99% of leaves have at least one insect bite in them.
Yeah. And I think as gardeners, sometimes we naively think that that's a bad thing. And it can be in certain circumstances. But in fact, as you said, that's in a lot of ways what fuels the planet. I think Doug Tallamy, the entomologist, is the one who's really led me to appreciate that, you know, it's insects who are able to eat leaves that then are able to transfer that energy that leaves store to other animals.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Through the food chain. So, yeah. So you said you worked with entomologists and in fact, you identified new species, even new genuses of insects. And you write at one point that Arbonauts think that there may be up to, 90% of species or something like that, that are still identified up in the treetops? Is that possible?
Not identified, yeah.
Unidentified, I mean, right.
Because we now appreciate there's probably 50% of terrestrial biodiversity in the canopy, we know we haven't gotten much past 10%. There are so many, many things that haven't been classified because there's still only a handful of Arbonauts. You know, if this were an area where every scientist or every graduate school class was exploring the way they might do with marshes or fields or urban lawns where people are combing the area day in and day out, you would say, oh, we've probably covered a lot of ground. But, you know, the canopy, we have only a handful of people. There's so many species of trees, 60,000 plus, that have never been climbed before. So you can be sure that new things abound.
So how do you become an Arbonaut?
You go to school and you study math and biology if you possibly can, because I think learning statistics is really important as well as learning natural history. You use your five senses after school to learn to smell and see and hear things out in the forest. And maybe you go on to get a college degree and you learn somewhere along the line how to climb a tree. Maybe you do an internship or maybe you take a class because there now are recreational climbing classes. And maybe you end up with a professor that's a forest scientist. But it is not necessarily an easy path. It's not something like nursing school or medical school where it's very easy to identify all of those places. And that's part of the problem for conservation is that having experts in forest science is not an easy path. It's not as well defined even as becoming an astronaut. So we have a problem on planet Earth for doing the right thing by getting experts to understand our ecosystems.
Yeah, that is a problem because, you know, in dwelling on climate change, one of the things that often crosses my mind is how much work our younger generation has cut out for them. And obviously, one of the things one thinks about is like, what are the careers that they might take on that could potentially help us going forward? That's interesting. I wanted to mention, too, that you discovered in your work in Australia that working at night is often a good time to discover a lot. You tell a story about, I think, camping somewhere and you're trying to identify who is eating this particular tree. I think it's a coachwood tree, right? And in the middle of the night, you have to get up to go to the bathroom and you hear this sound. And it turns out that it's all these beetles crunching on the leaves at nighttime.
Absolutely. And again, I tell every student, you know, a lot of science is eureka discoveries, just totally by chance. You don't strategize and say, I think this is the right thing. But, you know, here I was going to the outhouse and getting a major discovery. I had climbed the trees for 18 months and saw almost no insects by day. I couldn't believe what I assumed was my own stupidity because I kept missing these bugs. And yet I saw the damage they were incurring in the leaves. And yet, lo and behold, of course they were feeding at night. Why not? Because they avoid being eaten by birds in the daylight. So it was one of those, again, hit you over the head science discoveries that I should have thought of that. And so should have 100 other scientists. But we never realized that birds would be very smart and very logical about avoiding their own predators. insects would be.
Right. Avoiding birds. So that must have made for some interesting climbs. in the nighttime. Was it? Because the other thing is that, you know, it can be dangerous, right? You talk about in Australia, you know, leeches, poisonous snakes. Oh. I mean, I can only imagine in the Amazon and in India, there are also tigers that you encounter. So the nighttime climbs must be heart pounding.
They are a bit. Indeed, they are. That's why we, I guess, young graduate students do a lot of this work. We're probably more fearless.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, I think the passion for discovery and the excitement of finding answers to important questions to save these forests is the driver for overcoming that fear.
It must be exhilarating. So you never had any particularly bad encounters with snakes or any other kind of dangerous?
I had my share of insect bites and ant communities that weren't very friendly, and probably moments when my heart was pounding, yes, but fortunately pretty good. I fell out of one tree, but by daylight, just due to my own kind of safety oversights, because I was in a hurry. And that's a good lesson for anybody. We have to always have safety first. Climbing is not too much different from bicycle riding or other sports where you need to focus on making sure you're doing the right thing.
Right. That makes sense. So segueing a little bit to climate change, so we've been talking about insects eating leaves, and under normal conditions, it's not really a problem for the tree, right? My sense is that insects can eat up to, what, maybe a quarter of the leaves, something like that, and the tree is fine. But then when you were working in Australia, you encountered this situation with the eucalyptus or gum trees, where the trees were dying and they were being attacked by insects, and you were trying to figure out what was causing that. And my sense is that was linked to climate change. Can you explain what was going on there?
Yeah, it's amazing to think about this, but this was the 1980s. I just come away from 5 or 6 years in the Australian tropical forest, the wet forests, and probably was the only, you know, green card professional tree climber in the country with regard to science. So I basically got asked to look at this dry forest problem where all the trees were dying. And they knew in Western Australia that a fungus had come in on avocado seedlings and was killing all the root systems of the gum trees. And they knew in South Australia that salt was encroaching because of human clearing and water table depletion, and that was a thing. But in New South Wales, it was complicated and nobody was really sure why all the trees were dying. So I did get a research grant to study that and applied my same methods. Let's look at the whole tree, not just the bottom of the tree. And lo and behold, it did become obvious that a couple insect pests were major, and because it was hotter and drier, we had this amazing drought and hot spells. We didn't call it climate change then. We didn't know that term in the world of ecology. We thought it was some 100-year anomaly, and lo and behold, of course, now we know differently, that that was really the beginning of this sort of situation where there was so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that the hotter and drier scenario was becoming every other year or even every decade or whatever. It was not a 100-year event at all. So we have to now realize that one of the issues for forests to stay healthy is the fact that climate change makes insects survive so much better. They love hot and dry conditions. They love droughts because their eggs hatch more frequently and they get up there and eat all the leaves and the remaining trees. So that was really the problem with the gum tree dieback.
What are some of the other effects that climate change is having on forests specifically?
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, number one is forests, of course, are an antidote to climate change. They are so, so important for pulling out that carbon dioxide and storing the carbon and shading things and housing biodiversity that has the future cure for diseases or whatever medicinal uses. There's in having most of our foods and our, of course, sustainable timber come from trees. So we need to protect trees, but right now, with climate change, we have twofold problem with human beings. One is we're reducing the sizes of forests and we're fragmenting them. So they're automatically hotter and drier because when you have smaller little fragments of forests, the borders are all dry and hot and sultry, and there's less shady interior. So the trees are very stressed, and the insects love that because they love to come to stressed trees and eat them all up. And we not only have that, but now we have the fire issue because fragments of forest are drier and they're much more prone to both natural and human caused fires, whether or not it's a lightning strike, a person dropping a cigarette, or some farmer burning the edges of his fields, which then catches light to the forest. We have the whole world's forests on fire. And I think, you know, in 2020, we had Siberia, Amazon, Australia, California, you know, Mediterranean, extraordinarily terrible fires just eating up our forests. And those are not replaceable for probably up to 1,000 years. This is not good for our children. Maybe our great-great-grandchildren will benefit if those trees ever survive. But that's my other message. It's not good enough to plant trees. We have to save the big trees.
How do we do that?
We create national parks. We incentivize ecotourism. We make it sexy and fun to visit forests, like building canopy walkways, which is my last chapter of the book, this project I call Mission Green, to build these walkways for ecotourism in the most endangered forests in the world. So people will love going there and love visiting them and pay money to local people to save the forests. But, you know, I love planting trees and every school should plant trees, but that might help us today feel good. But those trees will not house koala bears or feed sloths for 100, if not 500 years. And so they really aren't going to benefit the immediate problems that we've created by clearing and burning forests. So we cannot use that as a very cheap, lame excuse. We need to save big trees. We need to be ruthless. Counties need to say, at all costs, if you want to expand your garage, can't you do it in the other direction? Don't cut down a tree. If you want to build a mall and there's a big live oak there, make a courtyard around it. We have to consider them as the most precious senior citizens that we have on the planet.
Yeah. You also mentioned the idea that wealthier countries should help poorer countries financially in order to help them maintain their forests.
Right. Well, we obviously know that we've put the most carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and we've consumed the most amount of timber and the most amount of any natural resource because we've built up this wealthy economy. So how do you compensate these people? Because a lot of the poor countries like Ethiopia or India or other places don't have the benefits of us using a disproportionate amount of the natural resources, but they have the disadvantage of getting the droughts and not having air conditioning and getting the floods and not having the budgets to fix the roads. So somehow we have to make it equitable. And the amazing thing is we have a lot of technology that we could share, and we could probably even prosper by selling things like clean energy and fantastic, you know, forest canopy walkway projects to all these countries, which could then in turn make more money from them and stay healthier from them. So I think it's not giving things up. It's how do we innovate with our technologies and share it with the world? And it's really immediate. It's not something that we want to just say, oh, our children might do that someday. But there's a lot of wealth in my generation in the 60 plus, and heaven forbid, but every single person probably should give half of it to trees and conservation, and then maybe our kids might have a life. You know, giving it just for vaccines is not going to help them if they're inside in a house with no oxygen and no trees and no medicines from the plants and no shade and no clean water and, you know, no biodiversity. I mean, what kind of life is that just to get a vaccine but have no ecosystems outdoors? So I think we're really, you know, heading in a very strange direction to use our technology for certain metrics, but not really looking at the whole earth health.
Do you have a sense, because you've interacted with so many people on this problem, do you have a sense of why culturally we're missing that or somehow not getting the message of the urgency of the situation?
I sort of think we love metrics. We love to say, oh, we've saved 1,000 children, or we've cured 1 million cases of malaria, but we never want to go back and say, oh, and by the way, the quality of their life is better because they have 1,000 trees in their neighborhood that it's producing oxygen for them. It's very hard to produce metrics around trees and planetary health in many ways. One of my challenges I talk about in the book is, you know, 2 billion people rely on trees for spiritual health. How do you put a dollar sign on that? So I think a lot of the philanthropists, God bless them, everything from the Gates Foundation to others say, we've saved 1 million kids from this disease, or we've injected 1 billion people from this disease, but it doesn't mean you've really helped their quality of life if the trees aren't cleansing the water and saving the floods from taking the soil out to the ocean and housing the pollinators of their local crops or producing the honey. None of that's really being paid attention to in the same way that just keeping people alive. But what does that mean to just keep people alive if there's not a quality of life in their surrounding natural capital, as we talked about earlier? And I'm just hoping and praying that some major philanthropist would recognize that. I know that Jeff Bezos is developing a not-for-profit with Amazon profits. I just wished he'd say, I'm going to dedicate, you know, $1 zillion to saving the Amazon. He would be the hero of the planet. He named his company after this river, and yet he ignores it, as far as I can tell. I would like to meet him. If he's out there, please connect me.
I can't believe I'd never put that together before. I mean, about the name of the company. How are things looking for the Amazon?
Terrible. More than terrible. And I have to be so careful because I speak to children every week. I do a lot of Zoom calls for middle schools and elementary schools, and I love doing that, but you have to provide them with hope. But quite honestly, we have exceeded what's called a tipping point, meaning it is not clear the Amazon can recover. And we continue to have the same trajectory. There is just so little. We pour money into the wrong places, which are governments like Brazil or corporate people that maybe say, oh, we're going to replant trees. Well, you don't just go down there and put 1 million seedlings in the ground and then fly home in your Learjet. You know, restoring the Amazon is a gigantic operation. And the much more important thing would be saving the bits of the Amazon that don't need restoring. And yet there still is way too much burning and clearing and progress, whatever that means, to create soy for America, to create beef for America. Most of it really is driven by our consumption in our country, and we could solve it overnight if we consumers decided to band together and find out where our products really come from.
Hmm. Oof, that's a lot.
Sorry about that.
No. It's hardly your fault.
That's why I ended that book on Mission Green. The last chapter is this chapter of hope, because I think it's very, very naughty of any scientist to end on the reality check, which is quite dismal. But we have to continue to look for those strands of hope and push people in the right direction to advocate and insist and try to do better in their own shopping and their own use of clean energy and their own saving of big trees. There are just so many wonderful things we can do if people get educated about it.
Yeah, that's true. So talk to me a bit about the canopy walkways that you've worked on. Can you describe maybe a couple of them?
Sure. And of course, the first one I was privileged to help design in Queensland, Australia in 1985, partly caused by me because I had these tree climber volunteers, and one of them got her hair caught up in the rope and the hardware, and she almost suffered some demise. But we sent up a pair of scissors and she cut off her hair and came back down very safely. But the owner of this lodge where we were staying said, you know, I'm a little nervous. Let's think of something different. And we drank a bottle of wine together and said, wouldn't it be cool to have a trail in the treetops? And lo and behold, the first aerial canopy walkway was built at that site in Queensland, Australia. And I brought that idea home to America and built the first walkway here at Williams College, where I was a professor, and then the first public canopy walkway in Myakka River State Park in Florida, which is still going strong after 20 years and bringing in 500,000 visitors a year, which is quite an economic driver. So over time, we've built these walkways in other places, I and some engineers and other wonderful people that create a diverse team of experts that can do this kind of work. And lo and behold, in most cases, they end up giving jobs to local people, especially families and sometimes women who are chefs and owners of ecotourist lodges and bird guides. And then the people look around and say, wow, we don't want to sell the trees for logs. We want to save it for this long-term income we're getting from ecotourism. So the project that I just launched called Mission Green is based on building these 10 canopy walkways in the 10 most endangered forests of the world quickly, so that we can save that genetic library. Because even if we can't save every acre of a forest in the Amazon, that is a humongous genetic library. And we need big enough reserves that fund the local people so they're not starving, that attract visitors to be educated, that help the world understand that this is like, it's like, you know, funding the Louvre Museum. We're just funding one piece. We're not funding all of Paris. Probably there's great artworks and many condos in Paris, but we're funding this one central place where we can say this is a hotspot for biodiversity and we're going to preserve it for our children to have as a resource in the future. And we need to do that in Madagascar and in India and in the redwood forests and a few other places that scientists are very clear about where those endangered forests lie. And yet this is a project that needs to happen in 10 years. It's not like funding a new football field or a great new coach. Things that, I hate to say it, don't need to happen today, but this needs to happen yesterday practically.
Yeah. Is that an effort that my listeners can contribute to?
Oh, please, please. It would be so great. And you can go online to www.treefoundation.org. That's our mothership. The Tree Foundation funds walkways around the world. It funded the Myakka Walkway in Florida and several others. And Mission Green is a major project of the Tree Foundation, but it's a 501c3, so all donations are tax deductible. And we are so, so hopeful of building a walkway in Madagascar next year and then moving on to Mozambique and also India in the next couple of years. I'm happy to say we have a walkway in Malaysia thanks to a corporate sponsor. So if there are any listeners that are CEOs or have access to heads of companies, what a fabulous gift. If you're part of Pepsi or Coke or Tervis Tumblr or anything going on where you say, you know what, we could do something wonderful and it would be named after us and every child in the universe would thank us. I mean, it's a fabulous thing to do. And I just wished, you know, we had 20 employees that could infiltrate every corporate place, because I think it's a great thing to do and it looks forward and yet it's today and it's also tomorrow. So we are so anxious to have donors of all shapes and sizes. Thank you.
Of course, I'm happy to promote that. I also wanted to touch on one of the themes of your book, which is what it was like as a woman scientist moving your way through fields that were dominated by men at the time, and the sexism, the sexual harassment that you faced at different points. Are things better, hopefully? Are there things that still need to be improved to create greater equity in the scientific community?
I think that's the major reason I wrote this book. I was so hopeful that women, as well as young men, would read the book, because it doesn't, you know, work if just women understand how to achieve equity. It has to be both genders. And I did definitely go through the hoops and had so many hurdles. And at the time, I just accepted them. I had no women mentors. I only ever had one woman boss. And she retired after she hired me, and then I was subject to the sea of men again. So it's just so important, I think, that women learn from what I call my misadventures so they can do things better. And that was really partly why I bared my soul to several embarrassing situations. And I had mostly male bosses. I had some fabulous male bosses whom I absolutely acknowledge in my book. But then I had a few, it only takes a few, that were so kind of negative that it sets you back. It's really hurtful because I think women are still tiptoeing. You know, I came from that generation in the 70s where I was happy to make the coffee at the faculty meeting to moving on and seeing women at the decision-making table. And yes, it's better, but I think it's delicately better because there still aren't 50% of women in boardrooms or leadership roles. It has not even come close to equity. So we can't just say, oh, it's great, more women are biology majors in college, or oh, more women are being hired by a company at the lowest of levels. It's got to trickle through and have women be advisors. Even in the world of natural history, I look around at who are the famous people that announce TV shows, you know, David Attenborough, David Suzuki, da 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 da. I mean, I don't know really one woman who MCs nature shows. It's still this white male world. So we've got to think about these things and try to make it better, I think, for girls to feel their voices heard.
I really appreciate that. Well, I find you a very inspiring figure, I have to say. And I've been telling my daughter about you. I wanted to read something you wrote too. You write, "I have two bits of wisdom to share with every young girl. One, don't ever hesitate to be smart and strong. Two, always nurture and support other women," which I think is a wonderful combination. Hopefully girls are feeling more comfortable showing their smarts. I have yet to see my daughter's 11, so we'll see how that goes moving forward. But also supporting other women is so important.
I think so too. And, you know, men have done that for a long time. I watched guys leave work and go to the golf course or the pub, and I went home to help with the homework or do the laundry. So I never was part of the deal or the promotion. I just watched that, and I was so grateful that I was in the workplace and I had my desk, but I never thought about the advantage that conferred to socialize with your counterparts and, you know, develop a rapport. And I think that's where women need to really help other women do better at that, because we were never kind of advised or told that that was how business deals happen.
Yeah. You write about how in the pubs in Australia, some of them didn't allow women, and that occasionally you brought along a couple of male friends so that you could go in there and...
Absolutely. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it must have been quite an adventure.
Wow.
I think, you know, just speaking about my daughter again briefly, I think that girls growing up now don't realize how recently so many avenues were closed to women. You know, I think in that sense, I think a lot of progress has been made, but that history gets quickly forgotten too. And it's important for them to learn it as well. So right. That they don't take things for granted.
My one fear for girls, because they're so confident now, which I love, mind you, but I also talk about this thing that we called in Australia the tall poppy syndrome. When a woman gets competitive with a man, there still is this subtle, insidious sort of knock them back or make sure the man wins out. I think women need to be still smarter and more strategic, because I don't think that's gone away. And when they do rise up in their trajectory, unless they have a fabulous woman boss or an amazingly unique male boss, they'll probably find themselves in the situation I did, where you just don't even want to talk about your accomplishments because it invokes jealousy or kind of negative feelings that hold you back. And that's just not how women should have to live.
I agree. And I think also gender roles are still in some ways relatively traditional. You write about the challenges of being a mother and doing the work that you do and being a single mother as well. That must have been difficult. I mean, on the other hand, your boys really benefited from being brought into the canopy and into your work at times. What was that like for them growing up?
I don't think they appreciated it then because they missed their share of school parties and they had to help their mom count leaves and other crazy things. But now they just are amazed. We do have fun talking about it. And I think for any parent, sharing nature with your children is a magical thing. For me, it was a little less magical because my job depended on it. I was very stressed trying to think, I've got to keep the kids healthy. I've got to keep them happy because I have to collect the data and it's my job security. So it wasn't quite the magic of being on a family vacation the way maybe some moms might have the privilege of if they had a dad working a fancy job and bringing in all the income. So I had a lot of extra pressure, but nonetheless, I'm grateful that I was able to share nature with my kids. And it did lead to a lot of lifetime bonding that is very special to us today.
That's lovely. I love that picture in your book of, I'm forgetting the name of the tree, but that giant leaf that they're holding.
Oh, yeah, the philodendron.
Oh, the philodendron, that's right. A human-sized leaf. It's quite something. Before we leave, I've been asking my guests if they have any advice for my listeners of one or two things that they can do to address climate change.
Absolutely. I would love to say, please save big trees at all costs. This is so easy. It will be successful while you sleep, but go to your community, your government, your county commissioners, whoever it takes, and say, please, please make it very, very strict to ever cut down or take away a big tree from your community, because they do far more than planting trees, than retaining saplings, than anything under the sun. Number two, I hope you'll educate your kids. I'd love you to read my book with your children. I'd love you to think of ways you can talk about these kind of issues, how science works to give us knowledge to solve problems, because our kids need to know that. And then the real challenge for, I think, all of America as the most advanced country in the world is educating consumers. And that's a big one. But if you have connections to the top, to Whole Foods, to Publix, to Starbucks coffee, whatever it takes, we need to buy products that are sustainably grown, that don't cut big trees down, that are absolutely in the most sustainable use of natural resources. Probably buy fewer fashions, probably recycle things where we can. But most of all, we can't buy coffee from places where they've cleared the forest. We can't have palm oil in our products of anything from lipstick to, you know, makeup to plastics. This palm oil is killing Indonesian forests. And same with the Amazon now, because they're planting palm oil everywhere. We just have to become smarter. We try to study things. We study what kind of car to buy. We study what kind of fashions we want to wear. Like, why don't we study our products? Don't just go buy the cheapest product, but buy the one that really is helping your kids save their quality of life.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I hope you enjoyed this interview. Remember to make a donation to treefoundation.org this holiday season as a present to yourself or to someone you love. Coming up, we'll have my interview with the founders of the Canary Project about the role of art in addressing climate change. And if you feel like giving me a gift this December, I would love you to write a positive review of the podcast wherever you listen and to tell a few friends to listen to In the Weeds. Just saying.